Welcome to US-China, searching for common ground. Journalists are critical intermediaries between American and Chinese societies as they report and interpret events for audiences in both countries. Yet, China has become an increasingly difficult place for American journalists. Chinese authorities have denied visas, placed restrictions on activities, and leveled criticism at Western media coverage of China. In turn, Chinese journalists have been forced to leave the United States. So how do American journalists on the China beat cope with these challenges? How can outsiders gain information about such controversial stories as the expanding detention camps in Xinjiang? Well, we're here today to find out from Austin Ramsey. He's a Hong Kong-based reporter for the New York Times and focuses on coverage of the city as well as regional and breaking news. He previously covered major Asian events from Taipei and Beijing. He has covered the 2015 election in Myanmar and mass protest movements in Hong Kong and Taiwan, where he was based in 2014. Previously, Austin reported for Time magazine for a decade from 2003 to 2013. Other major assignments have included the Beijing Olympics, natural disasters such as China's massive and horrible 2008 earthquake, and China's response to the 2008 financial crisis. Austin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, it's our delight. And David, I think, why don't you kick off the questions?
Well, first I should say, since it's January 20th as we record this, happy inauguration day to everyone. You've been reporting from China for almost two decades, but in recent years, it's become difficult to, you've had trouble remaining credentialed to report from within the mainland. So now you're based in Hong Kong. Why are you not able to report from within the mainland? How far back does this go? And is it just you or is it other reporters as well?
So I started reporting in Hong Kong in 2003, and then I went to Beijing in 2007. I was forced to leave Beijing at the beginning of 2014. I just joined the New York Times. I left Time magazine and joined the New York Times. And at that time, the Chinese authorities were intent on punishing the newspaper because of a series of stories a Times reporter had done on Wen Jiabao, who was then the Chinese premier, and the large amounts of money that his family had amassed. So it wasn't anything I did aside from having joined the New York Times. And at that time, it was a bit unusual for a journalist to be forced to leave. It was not without precedent, but it was the sort of thing that happened every few years. It was generally a person who might be with a smaller outlet and who the authorities were upset with for coverage of one thing or another. So I went to Taiwan and then came to Hong Kong. Unfortunately, that sort of thing has become much more common. And so, you know, over the past year or so, there's been this sort of escalation between the U.S. and China over lots of things. But one of them is media and journalists. And so the U.S. has forced out some Chinese journalists, and China, in response, has forced out a large number of almost all American journalists from the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. And so it's a situation now where the Times has one correspondent based in mainland China, and everyone else has been forced out and are now either in Taiwan or South Korea.
I mean, that really helps set the stage for this question. I was wondering, Austin, one of your most explosive stories recently, of course, was the story on the mass detention of Muslims in the Xinjiang region. And this was based on hundreds of pages of internal Chinese government documents. So I wonder, how would you outline the key differences between doing an investigation that, you know, that controversial and that of that depth in your, you know, current position and, you know, on China versus how that might operate within the United States, especially given all these extra hurdles you were just talking about?
There's a lot of of considerations in terms of doing work like that, and the concerns about retaliation, not just to, you know, towards me and my colleague Chris Buckley, who did that story, but also our other colleagues. And so that's something we have to constantly be mindful of. Since so many of us have been forced to leave mainland China, we've done a lot of thinking about how, you know, how we can continue to report being at such a disadvantage of not actually being in the place. And it is a huge disadvantage. There's a lot you just can't capture. But there's still a lot that you can do. And reporting on Xinjiang, the region had grown so controlled that in a way it was almost like we didn't have access at all. I mean, it's not safe to say we didn't have access at all, because we could still send reporters there, but they were followed, harassed. It was also a situation where anyone you spoke with could be at great risk. So the last couple of trips that my colleagues did to Xinjiang, they didn't really interview anyone. They walked around, they saw things, they saw what was happening, but to try and talk to, you know, anyone would put them at great risk. So in a way it wasn't reporting as we know it. And unfortunately that's now becoming what our reporting on all of China is like. In some ways, we do have one correspondent there and several local reporters who work for us, but you know, it's hard. And so you end up doing a lot of things remotely, a lot of time on the phones, reading state media and things people put on Weibo and stuff like that. And you can still, you know, get a lot as we were able to do with some of the Xinjiang reporting, but it makes you much more aware of all the things that you're probably missing.
Yeah. And what was your reaction to that investigation, you know, of the detention camps, which I assume China would call schools, and, you know, which I've seen in them to describe them as, right, in some reports.
Yeah. So that story was, it was in late 2019. It was a huge amount of work, had a lot of repercussions. My colleague Chris Buckley, who I did that with, he's sort of like the dean of China correspondence. He was forced to leave, and you know, with these things, Chris is Australian, so he was not caught up in the sort of Sino-US expulsions, and it's not clear exactly why they wanted him out, but it seems that this was likely at least part of it. And he was forced to leave mainland China, and then came to Hong Kong and was forced to leave Hong Kong as well. And that's something that's somewhat new. Hong Kong has often been a place where journalists who are forced to leave mainland China come and work, and you can still, you know, do quite a bit of reporting on the rest of China from here. But there, Chris and other foreign journalists have been forced to leave here as you know, the government, Chinese central government, really sort of is exerting greater control over the city. So yeah, it's, you know, there have been repercussions, but at the same time, I think it was important work to do. And I think it helped, you know, shed some light on that story. There's still a lot we don't know about what's happening in Xinjiang, but I think it helped explain some of what's happening in the background of how it came to be.
So I know some of your sources rely upon things like refugees from the region who've left the country. You've managed to get government documents, I assume, from folks in the Chinese establishment who may disagree with the policy. You've been able to, well, you and other, like BuzzFeed, for instance, have relied upon satellite photos and analysis. Those are some of the resources available. But you also, not you particularly, but I've seen press coverage of Xinjiang that has reported on the work of diaspora groups, right? Uyghurs outside of China who formed advocacy organizations, or Tibetans, for instance. Someone like Adrian Zins, who is an independent researcher. How do you assess the validity of that kind of information from those kind of sources when obviously they have a particular perspective and an interest in the story?
Sure. I mean, it's an important consideration. I mean, for a long time, it was quite difficult to get people to talk about Xinjiang, because you know, even if they were safe, even if they were overseas, there was a well-known pattern of retaliation that put people at risk. I think that changed a couple of years ago when people realized that keeping silent wasn't helping anyone, and often their families were having family members detained regardless. So, you know, in terms of analyzing or vetting information we receive from overseas groups, you know, you have to do everything within your power to check it. We did a story this past year on the destruction of religious sites, of mosques and temples. And there's a research group in Australia, and a researcher there went through thousands of sites and to see what happened to them. You know, he's an expert in this sort of thing. So we respect his work a lot, but at the same time, we also went through ourselves and checked everything that we could. Myself and a colleague vetted, went to those sites and looked for ourselves. And there were, you know, a handful that we disagreed on or thought that what was listed as destruction was, you know, something else that was happening. Maybe that some site that had been torn down was not necessarily part of a shrine complex or something like that. And so in the end, it adjusted a little bit the numbers, but, you know, the overall trend of destruction was quite clear. And we paired that with a visit by one of our reporters, one of our last visits to Xinjiang, who saw, you know, wasn't able to see thousands of sites, but he saw a couple of sites and saw clearly what was happening there. So, you know, it's what you do with any sort of reporting is try and vet and use whatever additional sources you can to confirm things as best as possible.
Those reporters who, Western or foreign reporters from Europe, Japan, Australia, et cetera, who continue to report from the mainland, what are conditions like for them? How pervasive is the surveillance? Do they have freedom? Are there restrictions on their freedom of movement or their ability to interview people and that sort of thing?
My sense from talking with those reporters is that things have in general have gotten a lot more difficult. You know, China is never an easy place to work. You know, there's not really the sort of tradition of free media, and so there's a lot of suspicion or towards journalists, obviously by the state, but also, you know, just by individuals. You know, I noticed that really clearly when I was forced to leave in 2014. I went from Beijing to Taipei, and it was just a world of difference. Of, you know, any official I went and talked to, we chat for an hour, 2 hours. It would sometimes I had to figure a way to get out of there because people just wanted to talk so much. And it was the same thing with talking to people on the street, just, you know, which is sometimes can be a tough thing to do as a reporter, just go up to a complete stranger and be like, hi, I'm a journalist. Can you tell me your thoughts on, you know, this political question or what have you? But in Taiwan, people were very open about it. It's not that way in China. And so in general, it's a difficult environment. But over the past couple of years, it's gotten very, very difficult. I think that's in particular for American reporters and people working for American outlets because of the Sino-US tensions. But I think it is tough for foreign journalists in general. And now I was just talking with a colleague a couple of weeks ago who had been in a big commercial city in Eastern China and talked about having, you know, state security come to his hotel and things like that. And he wasn't doing anything particularly sensitive. I think he was working on the economy and a story about how, you know, how well China is doing compared with the rest of the world during the pandemic. You know, it was the sort of level of harassment that in the past one might expect from doing like a very sensitive political story or a human rights story or something like that. You know, on top of that, I think there's maybe a little increase in xenophobia, which, you know, so something that's not directly related to journalism, but China has, you know, over the sort of second half of last year, has done a really good job in controlling coronavirus. and it's and the rest of the world really hasn't. And so it was in a situation where it's a lot of its new cases are people who have coming into China, and so they've really sort of hammered this message that China has the coronavirus pandemic under control, but the rest of the world doesn't, and you have to be suspicious of these people. And so there's been a, you know, in South China, in Guangzhou, there was a lot of discrimination against African migrants early last year. But I think it's something that foreigners in general have described. So on top of the sort of journalism specific issues that reporters face, there's also a, it seems to be a bit of an increase in xenophobia that makes things difficult.
Austin, since you mentioned the pandemic, why don't we just turn to that largest of news stories right now for a minute. Does anything remain to be told of the early phase of the pandemic in China? And then also, what do you think the net effect is going to be of the pandemic on the relationship between the two countries, you know, both the collaboration and the conflict? I mean, how many questions should be spurred by the coronavirus? China's had great success. What do you see as the issues going forward that, that might crop up in your work and the work of your colleagues?
I mean, in terms of you know, what still needs to be told, I mean, you know, there's a lot we don't know about the early early days of the pandemic and what happened in Wuhan in late 2019. And there's, you know, a WHO team that's now there starting to investigate finally. So there's a lot on those lines that isn't known. I also have there's a lot of journalists who have been reporting on that story for All Out for a year and probably would welcome a chance to do something else. You know, I mean, but it's, we've now reached, I think we've sort of reached the stage where this is a lot of like really big news stories that people will continue to follow for years and years, and things, you know, emerge often with time. I think it does have a big impact on relations between the US and China. You know, China has largely the pandemic under control. You know, I mean, they still have cases, and you know, here in Hong Kong, it sort of ebbs and flows, but we usually have 40 to 50 new cases each day. So a small number by sort of standards of the US and parts of Europe, but generally fairly under control. And I think it has done a lot to sort of, you know, China was for a long time, we've been on this trajectory to sort of surpass the U.S. in terms of GDP and things like that. And I think this probably helps accelerate that trajectory, you know, not just economically, but in terms of overall global clout and respect and that it commands in a lot of the world. And I think there's a lot of confidence that comes with having done such a good job on something that so many other places in the world have flubbed. You know, not everywhere has bungled its response. You know, Taiwan, New Zealand, Australia, South Korea, there's plenty of democracies that have done a good job. So it's not uniquely authoritarian thing that has enabled China to do this. But they have sort of described it as their system working. And you know, the US is still in many ways sort of the worst of the pandemic in terms of the numbers right now. So that sense of superiority and inferiority is I think is changing pretty dramatically right now, and the pandemic has a lot to do with it.
So you're based in Hong Kong now, and Hong Kong, even during the Cold War, was kind of a bridge between East and West, and for China's purposes, there was some utility in Hong Kong being different from the mainland, even after the handover, despite the criticisms of, you know, the lack of democracy. It was a very different place from a regular mainland city. But as we've all seen, that's changed very rapidly in the last year. So I'm curious, one, about the environment for journalists in Hong Kong. You mentioned that New York Times reporter Chris Buckley is unable to even report from Hong Kong. And of course, media mogul Jimmy Lai who was owned Apple Daily, the most independent, I guess, of the newspapers in Hong Kong, was arrested, and did they shut down the newspaper entirely, or
the newspaper is still operating, but Jimmy Lai is in jail and facing trial right now.
So what do you see the future of journalism in Hong Kong and the future of Hong Kong as, you know, is it going to be just another Chinese city, or will it retain some features that are still quite different?
Yeah, I mean, Hong Kong has always been a unique place, and you know, in terms of journalism, it's had a long tradition of aggressive and news media and protections for the press. You know, not absolute freedom, but particularly when you sort of compare it with the PRC, it's, you know, it's a very free media environment, and that is changing pretty quickly, pretty dramatically over the past year. Jimmy Lai was a big target for the Chinese state, and over the big protest movements in 2014 and then 2019, he was sort of seen as a leader. And I mean, in some ways, it's very, Apple Daily is very influential, has a lot of readers, and is sort of avowedly pro-democracy and has really supported the protest movements. But these movements, they have, particularly the last protest movement, had a lot of different leaders. So it wasn't Jimmy Lai behind the scenes calling the shots. But regardless, that the Chinese state had identified him early on as a target. And so when the national security law came down last year, he was arrested a couple of months afterward. And that law is sort of a part of a bigger campaign to really bring Hong Kong under control, to really thwart the opposition, to stop these protest movements. And part of that is making it difficult to do journalism here. There's a lot of fear here. You know, there's now the law has created this large number of like speech crimes, of phrases that can't be said. You know, the government said that one of the main slogans of the protest movement is now a banned phrase, and you know, could potentially put one in violation of national security law. And all this stuff makes it very difficult to do journalism here. And so, you know, in addition to Jimmy Lai, there's been a reporter from the RTHK, Radio Television Hong Kong, which is a government agency, but is also a very independent, very, very centrist news outlet. One of their journalists has been arrested, and it's in relation to coverage of the police, because they've been very critical of the Hong Kong police. And it seems like the police are going after RTHK, and they've had other news outlets raided over national security law investigation. So yeah, it's no longer a bastion of free speech that it once was.
I noticed that Jack Ma is the founder of Alibaba, which is kind of China's version of Amazon, but much bigger, actually. And also, he founded a financial firm called Ant, which was up for an IPO, and this government stepped in to stop it. This was shortly after he made some critical remarks of financial regulators, and now he's been kind of quieted. But he owns the South China Morning Post, which is the main English language newspaper. It's one that I rely upon a lot. You know, it's has had a good reputation in the past, and I think it still does very good reporting, although I think editorially, it reminds me of the Wall Street Journal, in that the news reporting is still quite good, but the editorial side is much more pro Beijing, I think, than it maybe 5 or 10 years ago. So there, you know, it makes me wonder whether that newspaper will also come under some pressure, as Ma is himself under pressure from Beijing.
Yeah, that's a you know, something that people in Hong Kong think about a lot, because it is the, you know, it's the biggest English language publication, and has a lot of great journalists working there, and they do a lot of good work. But, you know, the ownership does raise questions. You know, it's hard to say, you know, well, this story, that story is done differently because of Jack Ma or something like that. I can't think of specific examples of like that. Obviously their coverage of Jack Ma himself is, and Alibaba and all of his empire is quite fraught. But in terms of, you know, overall coverage of Hong Kong, you know, they do face a lot of scrutiny, and, you know, like any newspaper, it's never perfect. It's an act of doing the best you can in the time you have. And so, you know, there are flawed stories as there are everywhere, as, you know, as I know from personal experience, that not all journalism is perfect. So the fate of the Post is, you know, another important question about journalism in Hong Kong, and they still do a lot of great work, but how, you know, what'll happen in the future is an open question.
To extend this line of questioning maybe just a little bit further, I wonder about your perceptions of more of the, throughout your career, of the, I guess, more of the mainstream state journalists, you know, on the mainland. I wonder if you've had interesting encounters through the years. Part of this question comes from, you know, with my reporting trip to China in 2017, I was able to sit down with an opinion editor at a state-owned newspaper. And I never thought I would be sitting across, you know, the desk from somebody that had the title of an opinion editor, you know, in China. But I wonder your own encounters with your perceptions of actual, you know, full-blown state media and what you've seen of that through the years.
I know a lot of state media journalists and former state media journalists, some of them who are good friends. I think the nature of that sort of work has changed. You know, I mean, state media is always state media. They're always controlled by the Communist Party or the Chinese government. They're putting out the, you know, the official views of the state. But there are a lot of talented journalists working there, and people who go on to work for independent or more independent outlets and do a lot of good work. But I don't know. I think in this sort of increasingly politicized environment, I feel like I encounter that a lot less. And I feel like now it's more likely that people who are doing that work are truly committed to it. And, you know, I mean, part of that stuff is, you know, just, you know, when you talk about the opinion journalist, Yamada, you know, I'm not sure how much of that person's personal opinions goes into their work and how much it's, you know, channeling what the party or the state wants to be out there. But yeah, it does seem like, I mean, it, you know, I think this is partly because of the overall media environment in mainland China has become very, very restrictive. You know, we've been talking a lot about foreign reporters, but, you know, for Chinese reporters, it's become very restrictive as well. And so in the past, you had a lot of quite daring outlets who were doing a lot of very aggressive work, particularly ones based out of South China and Guangdong. But that still happens, you know, occasionally, but it's not the sort of regular thing that it, you know, it used to be, where every week there would be some new impressive investigation and people who are sort of always trying to see where the line was and getting as close to it as they could. It's a much more rare thing, and as the parties put a lot more control over media. So, you know, that's happened everywhere, and certainly in state media.
Has the more polarized and partisan media environment in America had any effect or made any impression in China? I mean, I would assume not, that largely doesn't get over the Great Firewall. But I just wonder, as you, in your career, in our careers, we've seen things, you know, really ramp up here in democracy in terms of the media industry. I just wonder if there's any impression of that you've felt through your coverage or your sources.
In Hong Kong, it's been very interesting because there has been a lot of support for Trump among the sort of pro-democracy side. And it's not universal by any means, and there's a lot of people who loathed him. But there was a significant number of people either in Hong Kong or sort of like overseas Chinese democracy advocates, or even some, you know, some activists within China who felt that who sort of supported him because for this sort of confrontation with China, and they were really cheering him on during the election. And so it was interesting to see that sort of direct engagement. And then over the past couple of months since the election, you know, there's been a number, I wouldn't even say it was a majority, but probably a very vocal minority that was quite in support of Trump and his efforts to overturn the election results. And so that got very fused in with sort of partisan media in the U.S. and saw a lot of people who become known for their views on Hong Kong were being very active and talking about the U.S. election. I mean, in some ways, probably the biggest example of that is the Falun Gong, the banned spiritual movement in China, which, you know, started their own media empire, which then became very deeply involved in the pro-Trump media world and Epoch Times and those outlets. And they sort of went all in for Trump. So yeah, there is crossover and sort of ways that I wouldn't have imagined a decade ago.
So often when I speak with Chinese students who come to the US after they've been here long enough to kind of pay attention to American media coverage of China, their almost universal response is that it's way too critical, that it's all negative, that they're not telling any of the good stories of what's happening in China. And so I guess I would ask, do you have any sense of where that comes from? Is it a contrast with their own media? Is it just a nationalist reaction? Have you run across that? And then more broadly, what do you think the Western media tends to get right about China? And what does the Western media perhaps tend to get wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I hear that fairly often. But I would also add that that I've heard that in every reporting job I've done, whether it's, you know, I heard that when I was an intern at the Des Moines Register at the, you know. so I think, you know, in a way, this is a version of sort of universal abuse of the media and this expectation that the media has to do 50% positive stories and 50% negative stories or something like that. And that's objectivity. And you know, that's not how the media works. That's not what we're here to do. So I think that, you know, is the basis of that. But then you have, you know, there is elements of nationalism. There's elements of, you know, how the media operates in China, which is, you know, particularly the state media and you know, what you see on CCTV and things like that is very different. You know, I think there is some validity in the sense that China is a huge country. Most of the journalists were based in Beijing. They end up doing a lot of politics stories, you know, a lot of stories about corruption and crackdowns and things like that. And there's a lot of layers of life that are missed in terms of arts and culture and society, how, you know, how people live their lives. And I think that's probably true of media anywhere. I mean, do we accurately reflect how people live their daily lives? It's a huge challenge, but it's a much bigger challenge in a place like China, where you have a big country, you have a lot of restrictions on journalism. You have a very small number of journalists doing the work, and you know your core obligation is to scrutinize. You know that you know that's the first priority to my mind of journalism. You know, not just in China, but anywhere. And so when you're left with that sort of triage, I guess it does create this sense that the media is always sort of attacking the state. But you know, at the same time, I had a discussion like that with a student who had gone through my stories, and she said, I found that your stories are 70% negative and 30% positive or something like that. And it was early on in my time in China, and my it was actually just a couple of years after the SARS outbreak, and one of my colleagues had I'd broken a really big story about the cover up of the outbreak, you know, and I sort of asked her, but is that a negative story? I mean, yeah, it's a cover up. It's a bad thing, but I think it ultimately helped save lives. So is that negative? So, I mean, that's how I look at these sort of questions. And yeah, it would be nice to have more time to delve more deeply into aspects of the lived experience in places. But in the end, like, scrutinizing what's happening is our chief priority, I think.
You know, it would have been funny if you told that student, well, actually, I'm 90% cynic, so 70% of negative stories isn't doing too bad.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I mean, I was a little surprised. I was like, wow, that's a lot of positive stories.
Well, Austin, this has been great, and I appreciate you spending time with us. We're just about ready to wrap up. I want to give David a chance to ask a more substantive question, but just one more frivolous thing I'll ask you. Name one of the most memorable places you ever visited in China and why that was. It doesn't have to be important. It doesn't have to be momentous. Just any memorable spot, a fleeting moment, and I realize it's not recent, but this is years ago.
So around about the time of the Olympics, the 2008 Beijing Olympics, I was working at Time magazine, and we embarked on this sort of like postcards from around China. Just, you know, sort of type of story we were just sort of talking about, where it was just like,
yeah, pretty positive. Fun,
finding these, unique places or experiences that people didn't know about. And so I went to Inner Mongolia to find this. There was this small tribe that they were hunters. They had lived as hunters for, you know, well into the 20th century, and you know, still had rights to have their own weapons and hunting rifles and guns and. So I went to track them down. Now it turned out that it was much more remote than I expected. So I flew into this small town and then realized that I was going to have to spend a couple of days in a car to get to this place. And I found these guys who were up for it, and we just went on this like epic road trip and eventually found this small place where there are a couple thousand of this group called the Owinki live. And got to spend a couple of days there. It was just some pretty wild experience hanging out with these folks and talking with the last of these sort of herders and their experiences and you know, it was a nice escape from Beijing and an opportunity to see a different part of the country.
Any final questions, David?
No, I'm good. I just so much appreciate Austin sharing with us and with the students, with our listeners, and you know, I wish you luck continuing on your journey to find the truth in China.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you, Kyle. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, Austin, and thank you, listeners, for listening to U.S.-China Searching for Common Ground. You can find us most places you prefer to listen to podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. We're hosted on Anchor, where you can find notes for each episode, including links to works by our guests, as well as a full transcript for this episode. Reach out to us by emailing david.skidmore@drake.edu.